Okay, looks like the board's back and SHPD is ready to go, so we can restart the meeting. So next we have the Dillingham Transportation Building, that's Angie. And Angie, can you just confirm, right, the Dillingham Transportation Building is already on the register, and this is another additional information?
Yes. Pages long and didn't really say anything about the building. It was done in 1979. Okay, there's the HART disclaimer. This one's going to be a little long-winded. I'm going to apologize before I start because I find the history of this one so interesting. Anyway, the Dillingham Transportation Building was completed in 1930 in memory of prominent Honolulu businessman Benjamin F. Dillingham by his son Walter Dillingham. The building was designed not only to house the corporate concerns of the Dillingham Company, but also to provide retail and tenant spaces for other businesses, which was unique for downtown Honolulu at that time. Located at the Mackay end of Bishop Street in Honolulu Central Business District, the building's primary facade is oriented towards the downtown thoroughfare, which was commonly referred to during the period of significance as Hawaii's Avenue of Pioneers. The first major wave of construction in Honolulu coincided with annexation and the Chinatown Fire in 1900. The Dillingham Transportation Building was constructed during Honolulu's second major building boom, 1919 to 1932, which was fueled by sugar, pineapple, shipping, and tourism. The development originally occupied the entire block bounded by Bishop, Queen, and Alakea Streets and Halikulila, which is now Ala Moana. It included the Dillingham Transportation Building along with a 250-car garage and a pair of two-story retail annexes. When the Dillingham Transportation Building was completed in 1930, it was among the grandest commercial buildings ever constructed in the Hawaiian Islands. Currently, it is only two extant historic properties of the period on Bishop Street, the other being the Alexander and Baldwin Building by Hart Wood. The garage and annexes have been demolished. The block is now bisected by a modern landscaped central courtyard that spans the length of the block between Queen and Ala Moana Boulevard and a modern commercial office complex with two 30-story towers occupying the southeastern half of the block.
The 1930 Dillingham
Transportation Building. Yeah, right there. I don't know what that red line is. I must have drawn a line. Anyway, was previously listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1979. This updated nomination serves to provide a more comprehensive survey of the historic property's architectural and historic significance. The historic property boundary is also amended because of the changes during the 1970s that were not included in the property's 1979 listing. Let me see if I can get rid of that line. Apparently not. Okay. The H. Lincoln Rogers designed the Dillingham Transportation Building in the Italian Renaissance Revival style. Boone Sadler was the mechanical engineer, and Marshall H. Webb was supervising architect. Rogers was born in Maine, studied at Columbia, the Pratt Institute, and Masquerade's Beaux Arts Atelier in New York City. He worked on several skyscrapers in New York until at the beginning of World War I, he was commissioned into the Navy Civil Engineer Corps. Shortly thereafter, he was promoted to commander and sent to San Diego, where he designed many of the Navy and Marine Corps facilities there. At the end of the war, he resigned his commission and opened architecture offices in both San Diego and Los Angeles. During the 20s, he designed numerous buildings in California. His designs typically incorporated Mediterranean-derived forms. Rogers felt these styles were the most appropriate for tropical-type climates. His interest in these styles was certainly influenced by Bertram Goodhue's use of Spanish colonial forms at the 1915 Panama California Exposition in San Diego. In Honolulu, Rogers used the Spanish mission style in the Army Navy YMCA from 1928, which is now the Hawaii State Art Museum. And the Dillingham Transportation Building was one of Rogers' last major commissions. You'll notice this YMCA in San Diego looks very much like the Dillingham Transportation Building. But preceded it by, I think, 4 years. The Dillingham Transportation Building was the first large commercial building in downtown designed entirely for rental tenants, offering customized spaces to suit their unique needs. Designed to attract a wide range of tenants, the building and its complex featured many modern amenities, including a restaurant, elevator service, and a full-service parking garage. The two-story parking garage, demolished in 1974, was separated from the four-story Dillingham Transportation Building by a motor court that extended the length of the block from Queen to Halekuʻiwila and allowed motors to pull into the parking garage from either thoroughfare. The garage had parking space for 250 automobiles and a garage staff that parked and serviced the vehicles. Flanking the parking garage at Queen Street and Halekuʻiwila were two-story annex buildings that were also demolished in 1974. They held additional shops and offices. And this right here is the entrance to the motor court. And there are some beautiful gates that were just past the view of this shot right here.
Walter F. Dillingham.
The building was named Transportation Building because the Dillingham family business was integrally involved in all types of Hawaii-centric transportation. B.F. Dillingham, to whom the building was dedicated, was a sailor from Massachusetts who went on to become the founder of the Dillingham Corporation. His son and successor, William F. Dillingham, was responsible for commissioning the building and was himself an important businessman, civic leader, and statesman. Walter, who took over the running of the Dillingham Ventures along with his brother, oversaw several major businesses and ventures in Hawaii that include the ORNL Railroad, Young Brothers Shipping, Hawaiian Dredging, and multiple land development companies. His company is responsible for the dredging and filling of the Waikiki wetlands, creation of the Alawai Canal, infrastructure construction at Pearl Harbor, and the development of residential subdivisions around Oahu. He also advocated for the formation of Inner Island Airways, which was begun in 1927. He also wielded considerable lobbying power on behalf of the territory of Hawaii in Washington, D.C. And it was noted in the same article that's quoted on the slide there that Walter Dillingham was a Harvard classmate of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and the article says, is as well known in Washington, New York, and Europe almost as he is in Hawaii. The home he built for his family on the slopes of Diamond Head in 1921, La Pietra, is also considered a Hawaii landmark. And I talked about his wife, Louise, with the Kamani trees. Okay, the original owner of the Dillingham Transportation Building was the Dillingham Transportation Building Company Limited, which was a partnership between B.F. Dillingham Company and the Los Angeles Steamship Company, or LASCO. LASCO began as a small freight and passenger shipping transport service that operated between San Francisco and Los Angeles. In 1922, the Dillingham Company became the Honolulu agent for LASCO, and the company purchased two former German vessels that were put into operation between Los Angeles and Honolulu in September of that year. So LASCO set out to be a luxury carrier, and the ships were well fitted and stocked and painted a gleaming white to reflect the prestige of the line. In initiating this new service from California to Hawaii, LASCO came in direct competition with Matson, who effectively owned sea travel and shipping on that route. But Walter Dillingham saw the potential for LASCO to make inroads into Matson's monopoly. Dillingham and LASCO tried unsuccessfully to break into the business of transporting Hawaii sugar and eventually came to understand that it was closed to them. But they did negotiate the shipping of pineapple with James Bowl. And they did have some success in capturing a share of the mainland passenger travel market from Matson in the 20s. But in October of 1922, one of their flagship passenger liners, the City of Honolulu, caught fire en route to the mainland. All the passenger and crew were rescued, but the ship was scuttled at sea at great financial loss. So they bought a second vessel, named it City of Honolulu again, and put it into the service in 1927. By 1929, still with expectations of eventually breaking Matson's monopoly on shipping and to and from Hawaii, planning construction began on the Dillingham Transportation Building. Drawings were completed in April of 29, and it was announced that Honolulu contractor Ralph E. Woolley was the low bidder of seven competing for the job. Woolley was awarded a contract of $619,000 and was given 325 days to complete the work. Unfortunately, as the building neared completion, disaster struck again.
In May of 1930, the second
Lasco City of Honolulu passenger liner caught fire at Pier 8 within sight of the Dillingham Transportation Building. The vessel burned for 6 hours, with the ship sunk at the pier. The loss of this second ship, combined with revenue losses due to the Great Depression at this time, doomed Lasco's partnership with Walter Dillingham in the building. By October 30, 1930, Walter Dillingham received notice that Lasco had sold controlling interest to Matson Navigation, and Lasco became a subsidiary of Matson 1 month after the opening of Dillingham Transportation Building. The Dillingham Transportation Building opened for business on September 4th, 1930. The Great Depression was not as severe on Hawaii businesses as on the mainland, but Honolulu still experienced a decline. During this time, even with rents in the building reduced, there were still many vacancies. Lasco moved out of the ground floor offices in March of 1931, and the B.F. Dillingham Company had to loan Dillingham Transportation Building money to meet mortgage payments. Matson was now half owner of the building, but advanced no money towards the deficit and did nothing to provide tenants. Vacancy in the building continued through the 30s, and World War II brought no relief. Low occupancy rates during the 30s and the freezing of business enterprises during World War II led Dillingham to assess their holdings in 1945. That year, they donated the Dillingham Transportation to Kauikeaulani Children's Hospital as a humanitarian gesture and for tax purposes. The Children's Hospital had been started in 1908, and Harold Dillingham, Walter's brother and partner, had been the president of the board for nearly 20 years. The hospital had initially planned to convert the Dillingham Transportation Building into a children's hospital, but those plans never materialized, and instead the hospital assumed management of the commercial building. Well, this guy. Robert L. Shivers. In the summer of 1939, Europe was on the verge of war. In the U.S., the FBI was working to prevent espionage and sabotage at home. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover turned a special agent in charge, Robert L. Shivers, to reopen the now strategically important FBI division in Honolulu. Shivers had become a special agent in the early 20s and had come up in the ranks with Hoover, and he was handpicked to run the Honolulu office because of his proven leadership abilities. Under Shivers, the FBI office was moved into the Dillingham Transportation Building in ever-expanding accommodations with an ever-expanding staff. By the end of the war, 33 agents and support staff worked in the Dillingham Building for Shivers. The FBI maintained their offices in rooms 301, 302, and 303 of the building. And the U.S. Army Intelligence, who was working alongside the FBI, were located on the second floor. It was in these offices that the interrogation of many Japanese and Japanese Americans occurred, including those eventually interned. Shivers was instrumental in preventing the mass internment of Japanese Americans in Hawaii. With the backing of U.S. Army General Delos Emmons, the military governor of Hawaii under martial law, from 1941 to 44, Shivers and his team conducted investigations from the FBI offices in the Dillingham Transportation Building. These investigations found no evidence that Japanese on Oahu had any traitorous intentions. Shivers was designated by Emmons as the sole authority to determine who would be interviewed and eventually interned. Although over 1,200 persons of Japanese ancestry were interned in Hawaii during the war, this was far fewer than the mass internments advocated by Washington and the number of those interned on the U.S. mainland. Shivers was later lauded by the territorial state of Hawaii for both safeguarding Hawaii's internal security and for displaying sympathy, sound judgment, and firmness. Instead of relying on lists provided by the military, Shivers had turned his attention to community-based sources of investigation, such as the local Honolulu police, including future Governor John Burns, who was the head of the Espionage Bureau, which was created at the request of Shivers, people, faculty from the University of Hawaii, and Oahu Japanese community leaders. Shivers was instrumental in the formation of Japanese community committees to promote U.S. loyalty and suppress subversive elements. When the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred, the members of these organizations went to the FBI office in the Dillingham Transportation Building to assist in putting into operation the plans they had made during the preceding months, preceding the outbreak of the hostilities. From its newly installed radio facilities, presumably in the Dillingham Transportation, that's not really confirmed, but I don't know where else they would be. The Honolulu FBI provided one of the very earliest notifications to the mainland of the aerial assault on Pearl Harbor. While more than 110 individuals of Japanese descent from the West Coast were relocated during World War II, fewer than 1% of the 160,000 persons of Japanese heritage in Hawaii were interned in Hawaii. And these internees were never charged, but their incarceration placated Washington bureaucrats who were advocating much stronger action against the Japanese population. Despite the very low percentage of people of Japanese ancestry interned in the islands, not a single act of enemy-directed sabotage was committed in the region following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Clear vindication for the policies and procedures implemented by Shivers and the other authorities who had placed their trust in his evaluation of the Hawaii Japanese community. Shivers also later contributed substantially to the mobilization of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Shivers suffered a debilitating heart attack in the June of 1942 and was unable to continue heading the FBI office in Honolulu. But he had come to love Hawaii so much that he enlisted the help of one of these advisors that he had been previously talking with, Hung Wai Chang, who had a close relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt. Ching flew to Washington in April of 1944 to speak to the First Lady. Shivers was appointed by the president as the collector of customs for Hawaii the next month. Shivers became a very well-known and respected figure in the territory of Hawaii and was even considered the front runner for post-war territorial governor. But this was not to be because of his declining health, which led to his death in 1950. Thank you for putting up with that. I think this guy is super cool, so I didn't want to leave too much out on him. The Dillingham Transportation Building exhibits the symmetry, scale, and classic details typical of the Italian Renaissance Revival styles. The three street-facing facades, Bishop Street, Queen Street, and Ala Moana, are treated with a high level of detail and ornament, much more so than the simpler rear elevation. The upper floors have a smooth, unadorned stucco surface that are reflective of both Revival styles. Landscaping is minimal, limited to small space between the building and the sidewalk. The rows of original concrete palm trees now tower over the Bishop Street and Ala Moana Boulevard facades. The front facade along Bishop Street features an arched loggia that spans the distance between the two outer wings. Come on, there we go. The loggia creates an open balcony at the second level featuring large cast stone planters raised on large square plinths. The Beaux Arts style is represented by the rusticated first floor and the use of classic details such as pilasters and cartouches and themed sculptural elements. The low-pitched hip roof is more indicative of the Mediterranean, as are the wrought iron grills and railings. Employing Renaissance Revival elements in a commanding way, the Dillingham Transportation Building stands as a significant architectural landscape in Honolulu's downtown. The building is 4 stories in height, with an additional partial 5th floor at the rear center of the building that was Dillingham's office. An open paved courtyard with trees planted in the center divides the Dillingham Transportation from the high-rise towers now. The eaves have exposed rafter tails, and between the rafters, the soffits are painted with alternating bright geometric motifs. An uninterrupted one-story arcaded loggia spans the ground floor along Bishop Street. The loggia on the front facade has 13 openings, and the piers supporting the arches are part of the building's structural grid. The interior side of the loggia contains the lobby entrance at its center, flanked by retail shops. A 1978 renovation removed 3 retail shops at each end, creating thoroughfares through the building to the new courtyard and high-rise office buildings beyond. The ground floor lobby is original and retains its original function as an ornate memorial library dedicated to Benjamin Franklin Dillingham. The building's lobby, although stylistically inconsistent with the exterior, exemplifies the Art Deco style, which was very modern at the time when it was called one of the city's most beautiful lobbies. Glazed terracotta tile, marble, mosaics are all arranged to emphasize height and verticality. It features highly stylized nautical and tropical motifs, along with more typical Art Deco ornamentation, such as chevrons and zigzags. The space also features architectural details relating to the life of Benjamin Dillingham. Of the lobby, Rogers says his use of ornamentation in the lobby was modified and conservative, which always makes me smile. Contributing to the decoration of the lobby ceiling was muralist Einar. Somebody can tell me if I'm not pronouncing that right. Einar Peterson, who also collaborated with Rogers on the Army-Navy YMCA building in Honolulu and the San Diego buildings, the 2 that I showed you previously. In Honolulu, Peterson also crafted the ceiling decoration in Honolulu Holly in 1929 and worked on the Alexander and Baldwin building that same year. The lobby's walls are clad with Italian and Spanish marble, and the floor pattern represents the restless surging waves of the sea. The scene is achieved with glazed terracotta tiles laid in a mosaic of varying shapes and sizes, including waves and chevrons with marble and bronze inserts. At the center of the lobby is a ship's compass wheel, and the compass is oriented to the room and not the cardinal directions, which is kind of funny. The 2nd through 4th floors have double-loaded central corridors extending the length of the building, terminating in a T on each end.
The Dillingham Transportation
Building, completed in 1930, is a historically and architecturally significant building. It is significant at the local, state, and national levels under National Register Criteria A, B, and C. Although the building has a memorial purpose with the lobby dedicated to Benjamin Franklin Dillingham, and its name and design elements intend to inform later generations of Dillingham's life. The primary use is as an office building, so it satisfies the requirements of criteria F for memorial properties. The period of significance is 1930 to 1978. The earlier years, the construction, and the 1978 date is when the building and site modifications were concluded. Under criteria A, the Dillingham Transportation Building is significant for its association with the history of commercial development in Honolulu and Hawaii, and it was the first large commercial building in downtown Honolulu designed entirely for rental tenants. The building is further significant for its association with the internment of Japanese and Japanese Americans during World War II, as the location of the FBI offices from which investigations were conducted and lists of arrestees were drawn up. Under criteria B, it is significant for both Walter Dillingham and Robert Shivers. By the time the Dillingham Transportation Building was in the planning stages in 1929, Walter Dillingham had become a proven leader of the Dillingham business concerns and a respected community leader. He founded Hawaiian Dredging in 1902 and served as the president of ORNL, as manager of Mokulea Ranch, and spokesman for Hawaii and Washington, D.C. Under criterion C, the building is eligible as an Italian Renaissance Revival style building with Mediterranean Renaissance Revival and Beaux-Arts influences.
Designed by Master Architect
Lincoln Rogers, the building is architecturally significant as an excellent example of the Mediterranean Revival style applied to commercial structure. Today, the Dillingham Transportation Building retains its original use, even maintaining a similar mix of tenants. The building and the adjacent high-rises are now owned by Pacific Guardian Center. And that's it.
Thank you, Angie. Okay, anybody have any questions for Angie?
I have a kind of comment question about the criteria exception G. Yeah, I see why you went there, because the way that the lobby is a little different and the way it's decorated. But I kind of think the criteria considerations are designed to deal with aspects of a property or a property that is primarily significant through the commemoration, if that makes sense. So let's say, for instance, there was a statue in the lobby that was dedicated to him that was built in 1940. You would then identify that as an object, and the significance would be as a commemorative object. But since this is contemporaneous with the building, and it's fairly consistent to have buildings dedicated to different people without them being purely commemorative. My call would have been not to bother checking that box, but that's pretty nuanced, I suppose. But I have a feeling when it's reviewed by the register, they may not want to bother doing it. I had to do those sometimes, like when I would do a property, say a fort in the back east, and then Franklin Roosevelt visited the fort and they left a plaque up for him. Then that would be an object within that complex that we would then call out as a commemorative property. But I don't know if you need to. I mean, you can say it's commemorative, but I don't think you need to cite the criteria consideration. That's all.
Yeah, and we debated that and decided that, you know, since it was there, we might as well address it and say that it didn't really apply.
Yeah. The other one was, I guess, the period of significance. That would make the period of significance run up to 42 years ago. Normally, we don't usually encourage the period of significance to run into the time period of less than 50 years ago. Just to be consistent on all of our other ones. I mean, the register time to time says don't just cut it off at 50 years. But when I tried to do one that was very similar to yours, when the Dr. Strode lived there for like 3 years, past 50 years, my advice from staff was that I stop it at 50 years. So,
yeah.
Curious.
We can change it if that's what you guys want. I mean, that's a super easy change. Or we can leave it and see, you know, what they say when we send it on to national. Either one's fine by us.
You understand. I'm just seeking consistency. I actually think your point is right, because something happened then. It makes sense. And one way to remember how to say Beaux-Arts is to remember H.L. Mencken's essay called The South, the Sierra of the Bozearts. So it sounds like a Z.
Beaux-Arts.
Just want to save you from future.
No, you just keep correcting me. It's fine. I don't mind.
But thank you. It was so interesting, and it was such a great nomination. And I love something. And the manager, I don't know if you worked with Brian, he's a delightful guy. He had me give a talk in the lobby one time, and he brought in a Rolls Royce with a bunch of people dressed as black things. And that was several years ago to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the building. And so
Obviously, I went on a little longer than I probably should have, because I just found the history of all this stuff so interesting that I had trouble cutting it out. So I apologize for going on.
Nancy Peacock. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Bill. Are you finished? Oh, you muted.
I'm through.
Okay. Well, this is Nancy. I just have a couple of quick questions. On section 9, page 38, it said the property acreage of the property is 1.5277 acres. So my question is, you don't have any boundary on this historic, is that like the whole site, or is that just what's under the building? Because it seems like the whole site is 1.5 acres, including the towers.
I don't have that in front of me,
I'm sorry. The boundary description towards the end of the nomination says it's just the footprint of the tower. If that number is wrong, which it sounds like it might be.
Doesn't it seem like 1.5 acres?
Yeah.
Going to be the whole, including the towers and the courtyard and everything?
It does. It does sound like that's too big a number.
So maybe that needs to be revised. That's on section 9, page 38.
Yeah, I know where you're talking.
That's the geographical data.
Yeah.
So it's only in the nomination, the written part, that you say it's only the footprint of the building that's the...
There's a section specifically dedicated to that. It's right before the photos, I believe, on the nomination form.
Okay. So it's a boundary. So my question is, does any of the courtyard count as this historic... part of this historic nomination, the courtyard in the back of the building between...
No, because the courtyard has been totally redone. Because it used to be a driveway.
So it's just the footprint of the building itself?
Yes.
Okay.
So originally there was, there was a little bit of a sidewalk, but most of that courtyard was driveway and then the building beyond, the car garage beyond.
Correct. Okay, thanks.
Any more comments or questions?
I have one question, if I may.
Go ahead, Bill. What
gates in the back?
What?
I was going to ask you about, Ms. Westfall, about the gates that were in the back, the attractive gates that were there.
Oh, yes,
What happened to them?
I wish I knew. There are, if you go and look, you can see one pier that's still there attached to the building, sort of, just a little bit of it. But I have no idea. I'm assuming they threw them away, sold them off. Who knows when they demolished it?
A building in the back where the high tower is. The gates were there. They removed the gates and put them on the little fountain area around there.
Oh, is that where the gates are? The gates there, really?
Yeah, they were the entrance to the Amfac company, I believe. So,
well, I'll have to go look.
Yeah, that's why I was about the gates.
Oh, I had no idea.
Okay. Huh. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Angie? Comments?
No.
Looks like Paul, you want to say something? No, okay. So you're reaching for your mute button. Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
I'll take a stab at it. I believe we have a motion to update the appointment to the historic register for the
accept the amended nomination.
Amend the nomination.
Accept the amended nomination.
Accept the amended nomination to update the record for the register.
I second it.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments or questions? Okay, we'll take a vote then. All in favor of accepting this amended nomination for the Dillingham Transportation Building for the Hawaii State Register and recommending for furthering on to the Federal Register, please raise your hand or say aye.
Aye.
One, two, three. Nancy?
Yes, aye.
Seven in favor, must be no noes.
And I will make that change, Nancy, that you okay. noted.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was very interested to find out that the open passageways are more recent. You know, they just feel like, I think they were pretty well done. They feel like they're a part of the building.
Yeah, yeah, they do. Even though I don't like them now. But yeah, they do. I didn't realize that they weren't there.
Now that you know.
Yes, now that I know, I don't like them. Oh, well. But
I walk under them, well, before you know, the pandemic. Yes. I walked under them, you know, constantly, and they're pretty nice. But.
Am I the only one that didn't know the gates were back there somewhere by the fountains?
I didn't know that.
Oh, okay, good. I don't feel quite so dumb then.
Bill Suza, I think, do you mean the gates that are over by, it's at the Amfact, you're talking about the Amfact Plaza?
Yeah, there's, I guess they're over by the fountains that are more towards Ala Moana Boulevard.
Yes, it's not really in the courtyard. I think it's in, am I right there, Bill Suza? You're talking about the ones that are over
it's
the
right.
Amfact, the Amfact garden. Yeah, okay.
So I know that those gates were there, but I had no idea what they were.
I ask a question. So there are some of the gates are over there in that little park over by the Amfact building, and some are over by Dillingham Transportation now. Is that what Bill said?
I was about one that was at the Amfact building that was Nancy was talking about that was removed and put to the side. I don't know about the Dillingham one. That's the first time I have heard about it. She did indicate that it was some remnants of it there, but I know of the others that have been moved over. I sit on one of the boards, we had it moved there.
That was like that Hackfell building, right? That they tore down and it connected to the old courthouse, right?
It was the Amfact building, the old one with the tower, and then they moved it. Yeah.
Hackfell, I guess, was Amfact later after they took it over.
American Factors.
Correct.
I guess it was seized during the First World War, right?
All right, thank you. Thanks, Angie. It looks like we can move on to the Kapalama Canal Bridge, which I believe is also Angie.
Nice. They're all me from here on out. Sorry, folks.
We don't have a problem with that.
Well, thank you. Come on. Bridge. The Kapalama Canal Bridge is a 113-foot long, 5-span reinforced concrete T-beam bridge that carries Dillingham Boulevard over the Kapalama Drainage Canal. This 1930s bridge has a parapet design featuring narrow arch top voids, a design that first appeared on Oahu bridges around 1930, same year the bridge was built. Earlier bridges tend to have solid concrete parapets, typically during the 1920s, and later parapets had cross-shaped voids that appeared around 1936. The bridge is located along a well-traveled commercial section of Dillingham Boulevard. The setting around the bridge has changed dramatically since its construction, when the area was around it was pretty much vacant flat land. Kapalama had begun to urbanize with the 1901 Kapi'olani Tract subdivision, which consisted of about 1,200 lots on a grid pattern within two north-south road blocks, Makai of King Street, between Kali'i and Pu'uhale. Further urbanization occurred around 1912 with the Bishop Estate Tract that extended east of the Kapi'olani Tract to Waikamilo. And Queen Street ran east-west through both of these subdivisions, terminating at Waikamilo. The area of Kapalama between the two ORNL lines and between Waikamilo and Iwile was planted in sugarcane at that time. By 1922, the city and county of Honolulu had plans to fill this vacant area with a grid of streets centered around the extension of Queen Street from Waikamilo to an intersection with King Street at Liliha. This was referred to as the West Queen Street Extension and would become Dillingham Boulevard. We've kind of talked about this. By the end of the 1920s, the city and county had laid down a solid fill road bed and installed sewer lines. An article in the Honolulu Star Bulletin reported that in February of 1930, the city and county of Honolulu was still waiting for this fill to settle before surfacing the roadway and installing curbs, walkways, and lighting. And some trees. The Kapalama Canal Bridge was built by the city and county of Honolulu in conjunction with the construction of the section of Dillingham Boulevard between Waikamilo and King Street. Also in 1930, the city was planning the canal, the Kapalama Drainage Canal, to join the area's two streams, Kapalama Stream and the Niuheliwai, to fill the same purpose as the Alawai Canal. And earth from the dredged canal would fill the nearby low-lying lands. The Kapalama Canal Bridge was planned to span this new canal at a cost of $35,000. However, the bridge was completed years before the canal was even begun. When built, the bridge spanned the streams and perhaps some portion of adjoining wetlands until the canal was dredged. In October of 1930, the new West Queen Street extension was renamed Dillingham Boulevard in honor of Benjamin F. Dillingham, as we've already heard. The full length of Dillingham Boulevard from Honolulu Pearl Harbor was in place by October of 1931, when it was called one of Honolulu's finest highways. The construction of the Kapalama Canal Bridge in 1930 and the development of Dillingham Boulevard opened the entire surrounding area for development. The Hawaiian Contract Company of Honolulu, a Dillingham company, completed the canal in February of 1939. The shape and configuration of the final drainage system includes a canal extending Mauka from Kapalama Basin along the approximate stream contour to near Vineyard Street, where narrower branch channels extend to School Street and Kapalama Avenue, School and Hoftailing Streets, and School and Liha Streets. When completed, the system contained 2.6 miles of canal and other drainage structures and drained nearly 1,200 acres. Numerous elements, including the draining of the area, the construction of the bridge and road, and the subsequent construction of the canal, were necessary for the transformation of Kapalama from wetlands to buildable acreage.
Can't hear you, Angie.
What?
Oh, I just, it's, you went mute there for a minute.
Yeah, because I blew it. I didn't turn to this slide. So this is 1939, and you can see the bridge is there, and the road is there, and the canal is there. So this was when the canal was brand new. So this is where I should be now, 1963. By the time of this 1963 aerial, nearly all the parcels surrounding the Kapalama Canal Bridge were fully developed, which marked the culmination of an industrial district that was envisioned by the city planners nearly four decades earlier. And you can see the trees. I'm pointing to them, but you can't see me do that. Another road running in roughly east and west direction towards Pearl Harbor was next. The 8-lane Honolulu to Pearl Harbor Nimitz Highway was built Mackay of Dillingham Boulevard. Its construction began in 1941, but took years to complete because of the war and other things, including the ending of ORNL and the removal of the tracks, that which was part of the construction of Nimitz. The concrete T-beam bridges are the most common type of extant pre-World War II bridges in the state of Hawaii. They are part of the evolution of reinforced concrete deck bridge technology in Hawaii that began with the first slab bridges around 1908. Often county designed, these early slab bridges frequently consisted of concrete decks replacing older type substructures on their original abutments, which were often mortared lava rock. Although the earliest T-beam bridges in Hawaii date from around 1912, after about 1925, this type of bridge became the preferred choice for bridge construction by the Territorial Highway Department. T-beam bridges in Hawaii generally had parapets with voids below a reinforced concrete rail cap. The pattern of reinforcing steel within the girders is a feature that most distinguishes the T-beam bridge from other concrete girder bridges. And you can see, and there's up in the middle top is a drawing of the parapet. All right. The bridge is about 113 feet in length, divided into five spans. The individual span lengths of approximately 23 feet are among the shortest span lengths for T-beam bridges in Hawaii. It's, although its overall length is somewhat typical. The bridge appears to be in fair condition with few alterations besides the resurfacing of the roadway. The reinforced concrete T-beam bridge carries Dillingham Boulevard, which is an asphalt surfaced roadway approximately 56 feet wide over the drainage canal. At both sides of the roadway crossing the bridge are 10-foot wide concrete walkways set about 5 inches higher than a roadway, which form curbs. At the ends of the parapets are rectangular concrete instanchions. Three sides of the instanchions have inset panels. Kapalama Canal is incised block letters is on the front panels of the northeast and southwest stanchions. And on the front panels of the northwest and southeast stanchions is the date 1930. The concrete parapets of the bridge are about 3 feet high. The upper surface of the top rail is slightly peaked. And between the rails are concrete panels with narrow arched openings. The substructure of the bridge consists of concrete abutments and masonry ring walls with coursed quarry-faced basalt lava rock set in concrete mortar. The four vents of the bridge are concrete transverse beams with beveled ends. And you can see the beveled ends there. Each transverse beam is supported by about 14 concrete square section piles that are driven down into the stream bed. The transverse beams in turn support the longitudinal concrete beams of the bridge superstructure. The 1930 Kapalama Canal Bridge is significant at the local level under Criterion A for its contribution to the development of an effective road transportation system on Oahu, and is part of Dillingham Boulevard, an important arterial in Honolulu's urban core. The bridge facilitated passage through Kapalama area and provided an improved linkage between downtown, the port area, and Pearl Harbor. The bridge is significant in the area of transportation. For the period from 1930, when the bridge was constructed, through 1949, when Nimitz Highway replaced Dillingham Boulevard as the main corridor in this vicinity. Between those dates, the bridge was a critical transportation route from downtown to Pearl Harbor and other points west. The Kapalama Canal Bridge retains a high level of integrity, with only setting being impacted due to the marked change in the area's density. The historic character of the bridge stanchions and parapets is still apparent, and the bridge reflects its historic appearance. That's it.
Thank you, Angie. Okay, any questions or comments for Angie?
I just have a quick one. You know, when it comes to like style or design, and we just write bridge, like, I know, is it like kind of like Roman arches, or like, is it possible to have more description other than just that it's bridge? Because I know we had some little Art Deco list. I mean, I think we saw an Art Deco bridge, and it seems like there is some nuance here. Those little arches, little Romanesque, or, you know, I don't know, neo-Romanesque, something like that.
They look Federalist to me.
Pardon?
They look like Federalist architecture of all the bridges.
Okay. Well, I mean, clearly it's a bridge. Okay. I'm just curious. It's, you know, that's all right.
Laura, you had a comment?
Yeah, I have a question, and maybe this is for Stanley to answer or Angie. I had read in earlier iterations of HART that it was going to be destroyed. And has that been, I hope not validated. I have a personal reason because my large public sculpture at HCC refers directly to the Dillingham Bridge and its arches. And so I would like to see it, of course, saved as a historical property. But can anybody tell me that?
I can. It's to remain.
Oh, good. Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Good news.
Yes.
I was worried there for a second.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Actually, I just wanted to ask Alan, what happens when a property that's on the register, either the state or historic register, then is destroyed? Does the nomination form still remain? I mean, it's no longer on the register, right?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the nomination then becomes documentation of the structure that was demolished. You know, and there would like, you know, in most circumstances, we would ask for additional documentation in terms of, you know, Habs hair, what have you. But the nomination itself simply remains there as part of the documentation.
Right. But is the property like no longer considered to be on the register if it doesn't exist?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the answer is yes. I mean, okay. I can say that for the state register. I wouldn't pretend to know what the national register does.
Yeah, I just wondered whether there's any, you know, sort of anybody notifies someone, you know, hey, that's no longer around, should it not be on the register? Or
I believe you can petition to get it taken off the same way you can if somebody drastically remodels a house or something that's on the register. So I think that same procedure can be undertaken should something be demolished.
Yeah.
Normally the delisting process is just exactly as Angie has described it. So formally delisting it would require somebody to go ahead and take it before the board and ask that they delist it.
And then when they're asked, why should we delist it? You say, because it no longer exists. And
well, if I was in the process of doing that, yes, that's exactly what I'd say.
Okay, thanks. Just curious about that. So, okay, any other questions or comments? Anybody like to make a motion? Anybody still awake? Hi, Paul.
I move that we place the Kapalama Canal Bridge on the state historic register. And was it going to be to the national as well, recommended? And recommended to the National Historic Register under criteria A.
I second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other comments or questions? Okay, let's take a vote then. All in favor of placing the Kapalama Canal Bridge on the Hawaii Historic Register with recommendation for the National Register under criteria A, please raise your hand and vote yes. So, Nancy?
Yes.
Yes, okay, we have 7 yeses and no nos. Congratulations, Angie. Okay, moving on to the Matson Navigation Company building.
Navigation
Company building. Heart disclaimer.
The Matson Navigation
Company building, built in 1952, is an excellent example of international style architecture in Hawaii, built during the territorial era and the former headquarters of Matson Navigation. Building is located at 79 South Nimitz Highway on Pier 11 in Honolulu.
It sits overlooking Nimitz Highway and facing downtown
Honolulu Business District.
The Matson Navigation Company
the building was built by the Territorial Board of Harbor Commissioners under a federal aid urban project, which included extensive work on the buildings and wharfs adjacent to Queen Street. Established after annexation in 1898, played an integral role in Honolulu's harbor development as well as other water-related transportation throughout the Hawaiian Islands. An official effort to improve Hawaii's harbor facilities and to expand commercial enterprises in Honolulu Harbor began in 1919. The improvements included wharf and pier construction along with harbor and canal dredging overseen by the Board of Harbor Commissioners. Eight, nine, and 10, along with the Aloha Tower, which is right there.
And then Pier 11
was completed the following year. The complex's construction was a turning point for Honolulu Harbor and represented the city's arrival into the modern transportation era. Expanded harbor services allowed for tremendous growth in the freight shipping and passenger steamship travel, fundamentally altering Hawaii's economy. Following World War II, Hawaii saw a building boom that included its harbors. In 1950, plans were made to alleviate traffic congestion by extending Nimitz Highway to downtown Honolulu and widening a portion of Queen Street to merge the highway with Kalikawila. As a result of the road widening and reconfiguration necessary to extend the highway, approximately 36,000 square feet of Pier 11 was demolished at its northeast end along Queen Street. And a traffic island, today's Walker Park, was created. Designed by architect Charles F. Wagner and completed in 1952 by contractor Moses Akiona, the building was conceived by Hawaii's Territorial Board of Commissioners after the portion of Pier 11 was demolished to make way for the highway. The building was then leased to Matson, who used the building as its Hawaii headquarters for nearly 20 years. Transporting construction materials to Hawaii is costly, and therefore the typical international style design language of steel frame curtain walls and glass were typically not followed here. Instead, reinforced concrete was used. Despite this, the minimal ornamentation, smooth stucco finish, ribbon windows, flush metal windows, and cantilevered facade canopy as seen on the building are hallmarks of the international style. The building has a trapezoidal footprint with three-story exterior staircases at each end and a vehicle entrance adjacent to the south stairway, which you can see down there in the corner, bottom corner. The irregular plan.
The irregular plan
addressed the architectural challenge of creating a functional space on the oddly shaped lot. On the interior, a central stair and lobby divided the first floor into two large office spaces. In keeping with the international style's rejection of grand lobbies, the building's lobby has no hierarchy in the building's interior scheme. The office spaces are streamlined in design and the building's sculptural exterior are appropriate for Hawaii's mild climate. And you can see those in plan right there. Arranged with central hallway flanked by office spaces. The nearly flat roof has a smooth concrete parapet that is emblematic of the international style's clean aesthetic.
What once the building was completed
in July of 1952, Mattson was awarded a 12-year lease from the Board of Harbor Commissioners. At the time, Mattson's third Lurline was docked at the pier, providing easy access for travelers. Prior to leasing the building, Mattson occupied offices in the Alexander and Young building in downtown and at Pier 9, but since the 1940s had been seeking to consolidate their operations. And as we've heard in other presentations, Mattson has long been the primary ocean shipping company in the Hawaiian Islands and played an integral role in Hawaii's tourism and commercial shipping industries. Beginning as early as 1914, the company's passenger services fueled Hawaii's tourism industry by introducing mass tourism to the island. Mattson underwent significant expansion during the 20s and 30s. After Aloha Tower and the passenger terminals at 8, 9, 10, and 11 were finished, Mattson Company used the complex for their cruise ships. The company also began investing in non-shipping enterprises such as real estate, sugar processing, and hotels. In 1927, the company's first luxury hotel, the Royal Hawaiian, was completed in Waikiki. Also in the 20s, they began expanding their services to Fiji and Tahiti. By 1930, Mattson owned 35 vessels. In 1932, they purchased Lasco, as we heard earlier, and the Moana Hotel in Waikiki, cementing their position of dominance. In 1936, Pan Am offered the first passenger flight from the continental U.S. to Honolulu. The 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor and the U.S.'s entrance into World War II restricted travel to Hawaii, and Mattson Navigation Company, luxury passenger liners and freight ships were drafted in the U.S. military service. After the war, the airline industry continued to expand dramatically, reducing cruise ship traffic to Hawaii. It was during this pivotal era, on the brink of the jet age, that Mattson moved into the newly completed building.
By 1955,
3 years later, 77% of all visitors to the island arrived by plane. So, enter the age of containerized trans-Pacific transportation. While Mattson was not the first shipping company to implement containerization, that was accomplished by Sealand, an Atlantic Coast company. Mattson became one of the most competitive, once the practice was established. By 1959, they had sold all of their non-shipping assets, including the Waikiki hotels. And in 1970, Mattson terminated its passenger travel altogether and sold its last two luxury liners. And today, Mattson remains a dominant cargo shipping company in Hawaii. And they have moved their offices to Sand Island.
In the early 80s,
Mattson invested $15 million in facilities on Sand Island, thereby consolidating its terminal operations in one location. The building now houses the Hawaii State Department of Transportation Harbors Division. The Harbors Division is tasked with planning, designing, constructing, operating, and maintaining state facilities in all modes of water transportation. They moved into the building somewhere around 1973, and the building was renamed the Harbor Administration Building, but is now formally named Haleiwa Kumoku. Building is an international style building, as I said, with a cubic form largely devoid of ornamentation. Its smooth wall surfaces are punctuated by horizontal bands of windows. The building's primary facade features a cantilevered canopy over a recessed entryway on the ground floor and ribbon windows spanning the second and third floors. The thin cantilevered concrete canopy at the center of the half of the ground floor level has a slightly canted underside. Freestanding round concrete columns sit just within the recess. Exterior alterations have occurred on the first floor. Originally, there were eight large glazed windows flanking the recessed entrance below the cantilevered canopy. However, these windows have been replaced with narrower window with glazing with applied mirror finish. Similarly, north of the cantilevered canopy, the facade originally had five narrower display window openings, two of which have been infilled. And south of the cantilevered canopy, facade's two large window openings remain, but have slightly altered profiles. Span the second and third floor elevations. The facade signage was replaced when Mattson moved out. It originally said Mattson Navigation Company between the second and third floors and serving all Hawaii at the roofline. It now reads Department of Transportation, Harbors Division, and there's no signage at the roofline.
The exterior stairways at the
buildings north and south elevations provide access from the interior to each floor and the rooftop. Partially engaged with the building, each landing is hexagonal in plan except the north second floor. At the first floor, the solid panels are decorated with a perforated hexagon pattern. Decorative stepped corbels provide minimal detail beneath the second and third floor landings. The north second floor is rectangular, extending to the north to connect with the deck that forms the second floor arcade of Pier 11 building. This deck is parallel to the pier quay, but still provides access from the north exterior stair to the second floor offices of the building. The deck, which is not part of Pier 11, the deck is part of Pier 11, not part of the building. It dates from 1920 and has scored concrete floors, double height ceiling, arches with squared piers and Doric imposts, and the railing arches is an alternating combination of replaced metal rails and original concrete panels with diamond perforations. The rear elevation is primarily characterized by rooms of flush, eight light metal pivot windows with continuous windowsill at each floor. The facade is flush, but for a slightly projecting bay at roughly midpoint where it meets the interior stair and lobby. The parking lot is triangular in plan. It's located at this elevation and is accessed by the drive that I mentioned previously. And let's see. The lobby. There we go. The building's primary entrance is through the recessed doors on the north elevation, which leads to a small glass partition lobby. To either side are aluminum storefront doors that open into long open plan offices. And on this side of the lobby, it opens into a larger stair and elevation lobby that extends to the rear of the building. The central stair is reinforced concrete and is partly cantilevered. The concrete treads and risers have been painted, as has the cantilevered mid-floor landings. The railings are simple metal bars with a koa wood handrail. On the first floor, there are two large open office spaces. And on the second and third floors, we have long north-south running central hallways with offices on either side. The Mattson Navigation Company the Mattson Navigation Company building is eligible under Criteria A in the category of commerce for its association with the Mattson Navigation Company. Mattson was the first tenant to occupy the building after its construction, serving as the company's headquarters in Hawaii for two decades. While headquartered in the building during Hawaii's territorial era, the Mattson Navigation Company constructed several Waikiki hotels, introduced new luxury passenger liners into service, and launched a container shipping system that would revolutionize the shipping industry. It's also eligible under Criteria A in the category of maritime history for its association with the Territorial Board of Harbor Commissioners and its place within Hawaii maritime history. The Harbor Commissioners oversaw the development of the Honolulu Harbor, Hawaii's main seaport, during the territorial era. The building is also eligible under Criterion C in the category of architecture for its distinctive international style design, which includes cantilevered canopy, smooth stucco walls, and expanses of ribbon windows. The period of significance begins in 1952 when the building was completed and extends through 1971, the year Mattson moved out, which is, now that I think about it, 1 year shy of 50. The Matson Navigation Company retains a high level of integrity across the seven aspects. Overall, the property retains its original form, original finishes from the 50s, including the original layouts and floor plans, and some furniture. Integrity of setting is the most impacted by the Aloha Tower Marketplace and numerous downtown high-rises, but its relationship to Nimitz Highway and Honolulu Harbor remain intact. The building has retained its strong association with Honolulu Harbor and Ocean Transit since its completion in 1952. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Angie. Okay, questions or comments for Angie?
Yeah, I have a couple of small questions. This is Nancy, by the way. On section 8, page 10, second paragraph down, you refer to current Walker Park.
Walker Park?
Yeah. What is that, Walker Park?
It's basically, sorry, I had to turn on lights. It's basically in the parking lot of Aloha Tower. It was created when they aligned Nimitz Highway and Ala Moana.
Oh, so it's not Irwin Park. It's actually another park from Irwin.
Another park. Yeah, it's basically in the parking lot there at Aloha Tower.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then one more, just to weigh in on this. I know we spend, because it's under criteria C, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful building. And, you know, we often spend a lot of time when we do know who the architect is, kind of talking about the architect and so forth, but there's virtually no information about this Wagner, or perhaps it's Wagner if you happen to be German, but there's nothing at all, zero, nada about the architect Wagner.
And there was nothing. There's nothing about his architectural career. We found a listing for him in the AIA registry for the years, you know, around 1950. And then there were a couple of mentions of him in the newspaper relating to baseball. He was like a baseball coach. We could not find another thing about this man.
Well, he's a really good architect.
If I did say so myself. Yeah, I love the building. It's beautiful, you know, and it's such a great solution to that, you know, angled lot. But we looked and looked and looked and could not find anything. Oh. Maybe somebody else can, but we tried. So yeah, there's basically nothing on him.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah.
You think he moved away from Hawaii maybe and went somewhere else?
No, because he kept coaching baseball.
Oh my God.
Maybe okay. He just changed careers. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. He was in the paper quite a bit for baseball.
Okay.
Good. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Just one thing on Walker Park. Isn't it that triangular park in front of Amfac? It's right across the street.
That's why I get them confused. One is Irwin and one is Walker. Irwin is
the big one in the Aloha Tower, and Walker Park is the little triangle where the gates are.
I had those backwards.
Yeah, that makes more sense because
it does.
Probably named after Henry Walker.
Yeah, Henry Walker,
Amfac, right? Henry Walker. Okay.
Yeah, that makes more sense. I had them backwards. Sorry.
No, just the.
We will be presenting those to you. I obviously didn't write those nominations, but those will be, I think, will be presented to you sometime next year, both those parks.
Okay.
Any further questions or comments? Okay. Anybody like to make a motion?
Sure, it's probably my turn. I move that the Matson Navigation Company building be listed on the Hawaii State Register under criteria A and C, and that it be forwarded on to the National Register for consideration.
Very nice, Pat.
Thank you.
Anybody like to second?
I'll second.
Someone beat me. That's okay.
Bill Salza was first. Great. Okay. Any other comments? Okay, take a vote, please. All in favor of placing the Matson Navigation Company building on the state register and forwarding to the national, please raise your hand or say aye.
Nancy, aye.
Okay, seven ayes. Okay. Zero nays.
Great.
Will it stay or will it go?
It's staying.
For now. I've heard that.
Yeah, for now. I mean, I can say that with pretty much confidence, more confidence than I had with the bridge.
I think probably with the rail it's not going, but I heard there's bigger plans.
Oh, really? Yeah, I don't know. I hope not. I like that building.
Okay, does anybody need a 5-minute break? Okay, continue on. Matson Line Warehouse.
Okay. Warehouse buildings are prefabricated portable, semi-cylindrical arched buildings with metal framing and sheathed in corrugated metal, or Quonset huts. The six Quonset huts are positioned in a compact row with their long axes parallel to each other and oriented parallel to Dillingham Boulevard. Is located on Dillingham in the Iwale Kapalama area of Honolulu.
In the block
bounded by Kokea and Alakawa streets. Let me see, I think I have a little arrow here. Yeah, there we go. It is situated among other industrial and commercial uses, including Honolulu Community Colleges, college offices, warehouses, stores, and small food establishments. The Matson Navigation Company purchased the 1001 Dillingham Boulevard lot from the Hawaiian Land Company for $300,000 in 1953. The site was planned as a new base yard to provide warehouse space for the hotels department of the Matson Navigation Company and for the 18 vessels in Matson's freighter fleet line and the Lurline to house carpentry, upholstery, paint, electrical, plumbing, and mechanical shops and centralized stores. The site replaced Matson's existing base yard in Waikiki, which is being cleared to provide landscaping and parking for Matson's new Princess Kaiolani Hotel. The Matson Navigation Company was founded by Sea Captain William Matson in 1882. I've been talking a lot, sorry. The business was originally considered shipping general merchandise, which included sugar and pineapple, but services soon expanded to include passenger freight service. By the time of his death in 1917, Matson's fleet included 14 of the largest, fastest, and most modern ships in the Pacific passenger freight class. His fleet introduced Hawaii to the world as a tourism destination. Matson, perhaps more than any other, was the most responsible for starting Hawaii's modern tourist industry in the 1900s. The historic significance of the Quonset Hut as a building typology was established in 1977 when the buildings at Camp Endicott in Davisville, Rhode Island, were listed on the National Register. Camp Endicott, a naval construction battalion, or CB base, was the birthplace of the American Quonset Hut, and it's named after their original construction location, Quonset Point, which is what that's a picture of, located in the Davisville base. More than 160,000 semi-cylindrical shaped prefabricated portable buildings were designed and produced at Davisville and shipped throughout the world. Because of its design and worldwide dispersion, the Quonset Hut is considered one of the most universal structures in the world.
Quonsets were prefabricated
and designed for use at advanced bases to be assembled by unskilled workers. They were developed in the early 1940s and were first manufactured in mid-1941 based on the design of the British Nissen Hut of World War I. You can let me know if I said that wrong. Quonset huts were manufactured by various companies, with Strand Steel Division of National Steel Company producing the largest number. They're found in two typical spans, 20 foot and 40 foot, with the mats at Quonset huts being the larger utility building type or elephant hut variety. The larger 40 foot span Quonset huts were built in 100 foot lengths and could occasionally be found as two joined structures forming a 40 by 200 foot building. A two story version of the 100 foot Quonset was also built.
The Manson Line Warehouse Quonset
huts are the larger 40 by 100 type, and the orientation of the corrugated panels covering is typical for that variety of military hut. They have vertically oriented panels on the ends, longitudinal panels along the sides, and transverse oriented panels along the roof, which you can see here. The Quonset huts all have doorways on their southeast ends. As mentioned, each hut measured 40 by 100, and their large scale entrances are located on that side there. In Hawaii, it is estimated that about 1,600 Quonset huts were in use by the military during World War II. When the war ended, military bases downsized both personnel and infrastructure. This process included selling surplus structures and equipment. In the post-World War period, a housing shortage resulted in a scarcity of building materials, and military surplus Quonset huts supplemented local construction and development at that time. Purchased on Oahu by civilian business owners, including Frank Fossey, industries and local governments for as little as $350 each, used Quonset huts were adapted to provide much needed housing as well as facilities for schools, industrial buildings, and warehousing. In the case of the Matson Line Warehouse, the Quonset huts were used as warehouse structures.
By 1954, all six Quonset huts were
erected on site. Three of them, it's not known which three, previously functioned as Matson shops at the Matson former base yard in Waikiki and were moved to Dillingham Boulevard when the property was being redeveloped. At least two of the Quonset huts were newly erected on the site, and no specific information was found about the origin of the sixth hut.
The 1950s marked the period
of steadily increasing tourist traffic to Hawaii. By the mid-1950s, Matson operated three hotels, including the Royal Hawaiian, the Moana Surfrider, and the newly completed Princess Kaiolani. By 1959, with the introduction of jet airliners and the arrival of statehood, the tourism industry was booming. It was that same year that Matson sold its Waikiki hotels, divesting itself of all non-shipping assets, as we learned earlier. Although Matson continued to own the Quonset warehouses, the 1959 sale of their hotel division meant that the Quonset likely stored their hotel equipment awaiting liquidation or items relating to their passenger or shipping business. In 1966, the Quonset hut lot was sold to Annie K. Wong Leong Trust, and in 1973, the lot was leased to Irwin N. Thompson Limited. It was them that built the two and three-story buildings of the Dillingham Trade Center building on the eastern portion of the parcel. Matson Navigation Company continued to maintain the warehouse space in the Quonset huts until at least the mid-1970s. The Matson Line Warehouse Quonset huts are significant at the local level under criteria A and C as a rare extant group of distinctive military Quonset huts and for their reuse in the civilian community after the war. Under criterion A, they are example of post-war practices of adapting World War II era military Quonset huts for contemporary civilian use. The period of significance for this criteria is 1954, the year the huts were erected on and moved to the site. Property is also significant under criteria C as a rare extant grouping of architecturally distinctive military Quonset huts. The period of significance for this criteria is 1943 to 1945. The period during which World War II, when several of the original Quonset huts would have been manufactured, shipped to Oahu, erected, and used. The Matson Line Warehouse grouping retains sufficient integrity. Although several of the Quonset huts were relocated to this site, the move occurred prior to the period of significance, so the relocation does not affect integrity of location. Integrity of setting is partially retained, although the surrounding urban environment is now more densely built up than when the Quonsets were erected. The intact metal shells retain integrity of materials, design, and workmanship. Their recognizable arched half-barrel form and massing is intact, although some huts have been altered with some added doors and ventilation features on the roof. Integrity of feeling and association are also retained. There we go.
Thank you, Angie. Okay, questions or for Angie or comments?
Yeah, Nancy Peacock weighing in here. Can we go to section 9, page 21?
I don't have the nominations in front of me. I'm sorry.
Well, it's your Matson Line warehouse boundary page.
Okay.
I think that's Sabubu, because you have a white line around not only the warehouses, but like, it's like the whole block. And I think the reason I think that boundary is inaccurate is because if you go to look up the conforming and the contributing and non-contributing buildings, I actually drove in here the other day. And so I drove all around in there, and I think that it may be owned by one person or one, it's like a whole block of buildings, if anybody can look at section 9, page 21. But I think by your description of conforming and non-conforming, it has to be a much tighter site because you don't have acknowledgement of all the other buildings that are on that site according to the white line that's going around the property.
It sounds like you're 100% right. Can you look at that section right before the photos again and see what it says?
Sure, in terms of the contributing.
I'm sorry, I don't have these.
It's like contributing 6 and non-contributing 0.
right. No, so that's why I'm saying the boundary is.
There's consistency here between the boundary and the,
Yeah, I'm thinking that exhibit is probably wrong, but the boundary, the written boundary description that's near the end of the nomination right before the photos.
Okay, I'm right here. I have it right in front of me. Let me just.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't have these.
Yeah, because the map itself is, it's.
Yeah, it sounds like it's wrong because it should just be basically the footprint of the buildings.
The boundary buildings. Justification says boundary is the historic footprint of the 6 Quonset huts.
Yeah, so that's correct. It's just that exhibit sounds like it's wrong.
Yeah.
So that will need to be fixed.
Yeah. Okay.
I had a question, please.
Mm-hmm.
Are the Quonset huts that are on the Mackay side that are in a row, 5 in a row, and on the Malka side would be Dillingham and Honolulu Community College, is that correct?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, and then I think there was a big warehouse to the left, if you're looking at the property, the 5 little Quonset huts along the way there.
Those are the ones that were built in the 70s. They're on the same TMK.
Okay, good. Thank you so much. The only reason I know about it is my cousin used to live in one. They had one down in Waianae, and it's really neat. I wish I had one today. But
I know.
It's really nice.
I like them too.
Yeah, I also went and looked at...
Never mind.
Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Andrew, I know they had a big sale, surplus sale in like October 1945. And do you have any idea where these particular buildings might have been used before they were surplus property and made available to Madsen? Is there any, nothing on that? I was just curious.
Yeah, there was no information where Madsen bought them, because they bought two that they used in Waikiki, right? And then there were two that they put together on the site, or three. But yeah, we did a lot of research in the newspaper, and we saw where they were offering them for sale, but we couldn't nail down exactly.
That's really interesting. We're trying to save that one, you know, out near Leeward Community College, the one that's on the agriculture department land. So they want to tear it down. They just want to tear it down.
Yeah.
And we listed it. So thank you. It was really interesting.
Any more questions or comments? Yeah, I also went and looked at these and just sort of drove around the outside, and it really has that wonderful, super industrial feel that you have from Quad. I mean, I love Quonset Huts anyway, too. It just has that great feeling that you always seem to expect to find with any remaining Quonset Huts these days. So, quite an intact industrial little enclave there.
And I find it really interesting how closely packed they are to each other. About that much.
Right. I've never seen them that tightly together before.
I know.
Okay. If no more comments or questions, anybody like to make a motion?
Well, I'll do it. I thought I'd used up all my nominations at the beginning of the meeting, but since I guess it's my
turn. Have as many as you want, Nancy.
Oh, gee, thanks. So I move that we put the Madsen Line Warehouse on the under criteria A and C on the state historic and eligible for the national historic. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, any second?
I'll second that.
We all jump together.
Who can get to their mute button the fastest? Okay, Bill Chapman seconded it. Any other discussion? Okay, then take a vote, please. All in favor of placing the Madsen Line warehouses on the state register and recommending for the national register, say aye.
Me, Nancy, aye. Yes.
Seven yes. Okay, congratulations.
Thank you. And I will make that exhibit change so that it shows the correct footprint.
Yes, thank you, Andy. Okay, we have two more nominations. Just wanted to check if people want a quick break.
Madam Chair, before we do that, we received this morning a letter from the Department of Accounting and General Services, which is the property owner for the OR&L terminal, asking that this nomination be deferred. And I believe there are DAG's representatives on the call, if they want to say anything. If they're talking, they're mute. Oh, wait, there's one.
Hello, sorry. I'm sorry. Apologize, I don't have any video cameras, but my name is David DuPont. I am representing the Department of Accounting and General Services Public Works Division Planning Branch. As Dr. Donna had mentioned, we do have an EO for management of the property as the Liliha Civic Center. We have currently initiated efforts with the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corps, HHFDC, to redevelop the site for multi-use, mixed-use civic center, office space, affordable housing. It would primarily be utilizing the vacant portion of the property. We unfortunately received the notice for the nomination late, and we are requesting that the board defer action until we have a chance to review the impacts of the nomination and what that would mean for our future development for the site.
David, this is Nancy Peacock. What is your title? You're with DAGS, or are you?
Yeah, yes.
HHFDC.
So I am with DAGS, a project coordinator with the planning branch. DAGS is working with HHFDC. We have an MOU, and HHFDC is spearheading an effort for a master plan as well as an EA, EIS for the development of a Lillooet Civic Center.
When was that enacted? I mean, would that just be something that we should have known about, or like when did that come up?
Just recently, we executed the MOU just this past month.
Do you mind just telling me what that means? I'm sorry, I'm not that smart.
MOU stands for Memorandum of Understanding. My apologies.
Okay. That's okay.
So they have the funding, and they're spearheading the effort for development, at least the planning portion of the development of the Lillooet Civic Center. DAGS, because we have the EO, that's why we partnered and entered into that MOU for it. We've been collaborating with, as well as various other entities, looking at various agencies' interest in additional office space. We have a lot of offices that are leasing space in privately leased space, and so this is a means to kind of reduce the state's expenses and lease expenses.
And when did you say the MOU was
March of 2020.
March 2020. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, David. My name is Sarah Brahando, and I'm with HHFDC. Just to add on to what David was saying, we also submitted our letter requesting, you know, for this nomination to be postponed. I think we submitted it yesterday. We also received the notice a little bit late. Anyway, to add on to what David had said, we are planning to actually reach out to, SHPD, but we just hired a consultant recently in July 2020. So this is really very early at the stages. So I just want to add this. Thank you.
Do you have any, is Nancy Peacock, do you have any intention of tearing down the ORNL station or the archive building next door?
At this point, no, right?
Well, the ORNL building would remain. DAGS actually had a project back in the early 90s to actually build a civic center. We had planning and design funding, and I believe we actually had an agreement that from SHPD that would be okay to demolish the what we call the ORNL annex, the smaller building. But the main building, I believe it's the terminal building, would still remain. So we're trying to actually track down the actual letter for that. The letter was referenced in the 1991 EIS for the Lillooet Civic Center development back then.
One more question. Are you, because this was on the last meeting prior to this one too, because this one was deferred, if I'm not mistaken, ORNL was first on the agenda in the last meeting, which was in July, right? July 31st, this was on the agenda?
That's correct, Nancy.
So did it get, are you kind of asking for a deferral on this because the archive building was added? Because why didn't you oppose it like in July? Not oppose it, but withdraw it. Let's just put it that way. Withdraw it.
I actually do not recall receiving the letter from July. Apologies. It may have been misrouted. But yeah, our office didn't receive that particular letter or noticed.
Even though you're the owner? Okay. right. Just curious.
We are aware that both buildings are on the Hawaii Historic Register. But yeah, and we just don't know what the implications are with it being nominated to the National Register. And so we just need some time to at least discuss amongst ourselves and possibly with SHPTI on that impacts.
So these buildings are already on the Historic Register, both of them?
That's my understanding, yes. For the Hawaii Register.
Do you know what years they went on?
Unfortunately, I do not.
Well, I could tell you when. It was in 1987.
1987. See, I got another question. When it comes to ORNL, the document says that the property is 5.5 acres. And then it also says it's 0.06 acres. So, it, you know, I mean, it sounds like you're going to be deferring it anyway. At least it's sounding like that to me. But I think that the clarification on whether it's 5.5 acres or 0.06 acres, both are that in the same nomination. So.
Yeah, and the 5.5 acres might be referring to the original property size. From maybe like the 90s. I believe it was in the 2000s or somewhere thereafter. The property was subdivided and there's currently an affordable housing complex on a portion of it. So the remaining acreage for the ORNL property is about 3.79 acres.
Because yeah, there one place it says 5.5 and then another place it says 0.06, which I would imagine is the footprint directly underneath the buildings, not counting all the parking lots and all the stuff around there. But, you know, I'm not the one with the documents.
So, Nancy, are you talking about in the letter? That's the...
Well, in the nomination itself, which is, you know, I happen to have a printed version of it. So if you look on page, section 8, page 11, you'll see that it right there in the right under the narrative statement of significance, in that first paragraph, it says this 5.5 acre parcel. So that's where I picked up the 5.5. I picked up the 0.06 on another, oh gosh, I didn't tab it, but somewhere else in the description it says 0.06 acre. Let me see if I can find it. Let's see. Oh, here, on section 9, page 24. Under geographical data, acreage of property, item number 10, it says 0.06 acres, and in parentheses, it says 22,676 square feet. So I don't know if either one of those are accurate, actually. Just curious. The big difference. I know that Hart did this, I believe that Hart is partly responsible for this nomination coming to the board, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And I did remember, I wasn't at the last meeting, but I heard somebody say that they thought maybe they were planning on tearing down the archive building. And that's why they didn't, it was not part of the nomination.
And see, if I could jump in, and I think the other members of the board may remember this too, but I think it was being presented as two separate nominations, and I think the board recommended it be a single nomination since they were so closely related on the same property.
Not actually, no. That's
I don't think so.
No, they were. We had originally written it as a nomination for the ORNL terminal property, and included both buildings. But we were instructed to take the document storage building out because it was going to be demolished, was what we were told. And so last time I shared that information because somebody asked about the other building, and it was decided that it was going to be deferred, and that even though that other building might be demolished, that we should include it in the nomination, which is where it had started originally. And So that's why it was deferred, and that's why we're back here with both buildings included in the nomination the way it was originally. And Nancy, that's probably why we have a discrepancy in the acreage, because I may have just missed that. It may have been someplace that I just glossed over it. And we were going,
I think it's probably what happened is it's the numbers between those two, because if you added the footprint of the archive building or whatever you want to call it,
yeah, exactly,
the number would actually go up from the point, whatever, the less than an acre.
Yeah,
it's 0.06, it's probably, that number is probably going to go up. And then of course the 5.5 is, God knows, you know,
it's for the entire property.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
My apologies for not remembering it correctly, Angie, but.
Oh, no problem.
I know what, we basically knew that there was this other property, and I think the question was, why wasn't that part of it?
Right, and that's why it was deferred, so that we could, you know, document both of them, which I thought was a really good thing.
I have a quick question for David, and what would really be the advantage of putting it off at this point, when ultimately you're going to have to deal with it one way or the other anyway? And, you know, maybe it's just kind of a misunderstanding of what goes into being nominated. We just had an earlier nomination where it was already announced that it was going to be taken down as part of the process of development for the rail. I mean, you're going to have to deal with writing it off or something either way. And, you know, I don't know if you came up for the charrette up the architecture school that Kathy Hoshar did, but she did a charrette with a number of people brought in from outside to look at it. And what they did was just basically try to avoid these buildings. And of course, our hope always through historic preservationist hope is that they be incorporated somehow into the future development, not just be avoided as if they're like an archaeological site or something. So at some point you're going to have to make, I mean, the decision will be made one way or the other. Even if you say, well, we don't want the archive building, we want to tear it down. That may well be, and that may be what happens, but not having that decision won't save that issue. That's all.
Dr. Downer may or may not want to chime in on this at the moment, but the buildings have already been determined eligible. And for as far as your requirements for the, I think you, what were you saying, you're doing an EIS or an EA or whatever it was, you treat a building that's eligible the same as you would that's one that's on the register. So it's really not going to have any impact whether it's on or whether it's not at this point, because it's already been determined as eligible. Is that correct, Dr. Downer?
That's correct. The rules, both state and federal rules, treat listed and eligible properties identically in terms of the review of any potential impacts to them.
But back to my question, what would be the advantage of deferring this, since this would just mean we'll discuss it again another time, but.
I just, it's somewhat out of my wheelhouse, so I probably would defer it to our consulting team to discuss and give us the pros and cons for it and what the impacts would be.
Do you mind my asking who your consultant team is? It's Nancy Peacock.
I believe we have PBR, Hawaiian Associates, as the prime. They have a historic sub, I believe, was Fungate Associates. Sorry, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Incorrect, David. Yeah, PVR is the main consultant and a sub is Fung Associates.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for David or Dr. Downer?
I'd like to know if are we at a moment where we have to withdraw this, or can we go ahead and make a motion to put it on?
Yeah, I mean, the deferral is at the discretion of the board. I would say this though, since the board has adopted the agenda In order to defer, you know, to defer it at this point would take a motion for deferral. It would take a specific board action to do that.
So, anyway, if you're going to call for the question, Katie, just let me know. I think I'll make a motion.
Okay, Dr. Donner, do we need to allow Angie to make the presentation first about the property?
I think if the board intends to defer it, there's no need for the presentation to go forward. If the board obviously wants to take action on yes or no for the listing, then that would require the presentation.
Okay, so I think we need to have the question, would anybody like to make a motion to defer this?
I move that we continue with the nomination and not defer it at this point.
I second that, Nancy Peacock.
Okay, any other comments on that, comments or questions? Then we'll take a vote on Pat's motion to continue on with the nomination and to not defer it at this time. All in favor, hands up or say yes?
Yes, Nancy Peacock.
1, 2, 3. So we have 7 in favor of moving ahead with the presentation. And there you go, Angie.
I'm assuming you don't want me to go over the terminal building again, just talk about the document storage. Is that correct?
Sure. I mean, you could maybe just very briefly touch on that building, but you know, I think we did see that last time, except for Nancy did not see that.
Right. But I did read the nomination.
Right.
Right. Let me pull this up. Open, it won't share my screen. Ah, there we go. Okay, so for Nancy's benefit, I'll go through these real quick. So this is the terminal building designed by Guy Rothwell. This is the location of the buildings, the property. So this is the terminal building and this is the depot document storage building, depot building document storage. This is the gas station that was demolished in 2016 that was right here in Nancy. And we had some Dillingham history, some pictures from the site, the things that are already gone. 1927, you can see both the both buildings here. And these are buildings by Guy Rothwell. He did the Honolulu Stadium, Roosevelt High School, Honolulu Holly. He was one of the people that did Honolulu Holly. Okay. And pictures of the terminal building with its clock tower and arched arcade. This is interior view that's right inside there. This is, these are the railroad stops. So the railroad tracks used to actually run right here up to these. And this was where the passengers would embark and disembark. And the windows, the entry, and the integrity. For criterion A, for its association with the ORNL company, and C, for Mediterranean Revival style. The period of significance was from the beginning of the rail yard, basically, to 1961, when it quit being operating as a railroad. Okay, now, the document storage building, that's where we are today. Okay, another part of this one. The ORNL office and document storage building is a two-story classical revival style building built. Wait, what happened? Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay. Okay. I'm all messed up now. Classical Revival style building built in 1914 on the northeast side of the depot property. That's what I was trying to get to. The building is constructed of stucco-covered reinforced concrete. It's square in plan with an approximate 38 by 38 foot footprint and a pedimented gable roof, which is its most prominent feature. The building has a sill course at the bottom of the second floor windows and a string course between the first and second stories. The entry is centered on the southeast end and is capped with a pediment and flanked by small two light windows that have moldings. A projecting balcony supported by curved solid arch brackets is at the southeast side of the building, with a double door providing access from the second floor. The train tracks that once passed near the building have been removed, and it's now surrounded by a small strip of parking. The roof's large pediment continues along the eaves along both sides, and the narrow string course wraps all four facades just below the level of the eaves. The rear of the building, the gable is unadorned, and the roof is coated in concrete, and the gutters are incorporated into the roof and discharge at the rear. The single-story concrete vault structure that you see right here at the rear of the office and document storage building was 8x10 and separated from the building. This vault was constructed sometime between 1919 and 1927, and as you can see in this picture, has been demolished in around 2016. So this building right here, this picture is from 2015, I think, and the building is now gone. There are three types of windows on the building: small pivot windows, double hung windows, and larger replacement wood and glass jalousie windows. Inside the entry is a concrete floored central foyer with a concrete stairway, and the stairway balustrade features two large voids in the concrete to create a rail. On the second floor, the ceiling is very high, approximately 12 to 14 feet, as it follows the roof line. It has exposed concrete support beams along the walls and ceiling, and rectangular support columns are freestanding within the space. The significance of the document storage building is the same as that for the overall ORNL property. This one, obviously, under criteria C, is for a classic revival style as opposed to Mediterranean for the other building, and the period of significance is considered the same. And that's the quick version of that. Oh, I will stop sharing.
Thank you, Angie. So, any comments or questions for Angie?
I have a question I wanted to ask. Now, that last building we saw, that isn't that going to be torn down and suggested by one of the speakers?
We had heard it was going to be torn down, but I believe they just said it might not be. So I'm not sure.
So it's under discussion. It'll be under discussion.
Maybe that decision hasn't been made definitively at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
So I have a question, this Nancy Peacock, because if you, Hart is the one that asked us to review this nomination, I believe.
Correct.
So there's Hart, and then there's DAGS, and then there's HHFDC. So who has the, what's going on here? You know, there's three different entities that are all weighing in on this parcel. And is DAGS have a different idea about the situation than Hart? Or, because I understand, I believe that the Hart Rail is planning on coming right in through that area, if I'm not mistaken. If you look at the Hart, you know, the where the rail stations are and all that. If you look at the route.
Right, and that's why this building is being nominated as part of their mitigation.
So trying to get clarity on the three. Is Hart working together with DAGS and with HHFDC, or is there different different Kulianas?
Kulianas? Can I respond to that? This is Stanley Solomello from Hart. Our only requirement for this specific property is to prepare the nomination that has been put before you. That is it. So we're not privy to what is being discussed for potential future development.
What about Hart? Was Hart going to?
That's what I'm saying about Hart. We're not part of a development team. We are required under STIP 6 to document this property as a National Register nomination and submit it to SHPDI and to you for consideration and action.
Okay.
This is David DuPont from DAGS. Just a point of clarification. Yes, DAGS, the state, would be seeking to demolish document storage building.
Also, I would like to add, this is Sari from HHFDC. Both us, HHFDC, DAGS, and Hart are also working on another memorandum of agreement because, like you were saying, the rail does go through there.
Angie, the future of this building, notwithstanding, looking at it, you mentioned that it has integrity under criteria A and C. It looked from the photos that the building is in good shape. I didn't see any spalling. It didn't look like there was deterioration with any of the concrete or anything. Can you describe a little bit the condition of the structure as it stands now?
The structure is in excellent condition. It's being actively used. At least it was, you know, when we were there. I'm not sure whether today it is. But you can see for a 1914 building, it's in remarkably good condition. It's been upkept. And as far as our visual inspection of it, there's no problem structurally or anything else with the building. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. I put myself on mute too soon. Thanks, Angie.
Okay. Any more questions for Angie or for anyone else? Okay, would somebody like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion. I move that we put the ORNL company terminal depot building and the document storage building on the state register and eligible for the national register.
Under criterion
A and C.
And C, thank you. Okay, do I hear a second?
I will second, Alton.
Alton. Okay.
Second to Alton. Sorry, Paul, he just beat you out.
I'll blurred it.
Yeah. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, well then we'll have a vote on who made that motion?
Nancy.
Nancy made the motion to put the ORNL property onto the state register with recommendation for the national register. All in favor, raise your hand or say aye, please.
Aye.
Yes, Nancy Peacock, yes.
Okay, we have 7 yeses and 0 noes. Thank you. Any other comments on this one before we move on? Thank you. I propose if you guys want to just take a 5-minute break before we move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. Should we have a vote on that?
I vote yes.
Okay, 5-minute break. We'll be back at 2:42.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, we're just looking for Bill and Alton and Nancy. So let me know if you guys are back.
I'm back. Nancy Peacock is back.
Thank you, Nancy.
I'm still here.
Hi, Alton. Okay. Did I hear you, Bill Sousa?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
It's waiting for Bill Chapman. Once again, I think he has the furthest to travel for his breaks.
Is that his real background?
No, I think that's a Zoom background. And I don't know if it's his own photo or if it's something. Oh, it's got Diamond Head, so it's got to be his own photo.
Yeah. I'm just like, oh, I want to be where he is. No wonder he takes long.
He was in a swamp earlier this morning, but he's cleaned himself up and sat by the view now.
He's actually at the Architecture School because that's where I am too. I'm just in a different room.
So Nancy, you can confirm that that's not really his view.
Yeah, and I don't know where the hell he is. Oh, heck, he is. Hold on. He's missing in action. I don't know where he is. He's in the next room, so.
Angie, you're doing yeoman work with us today. You deserve to go home and take a really fabulous, relaxing break of your choice.
Well, I'm glad this is the last one because my tongue is tied and my eyes are crossing. And so I'm not sure I could do much more.
Yeah, it's hard enough for us just to sit here for 6 hours.
I know. And I should make them shorter, but I'm really trying to, you know, entertain you, I guess.
They're all interesting.
Oh, thank you. I think so. I didn't really write very many of this batch. So
I saw that in the signatures.
Yeah. So I've learned a lot just preparing the presentations. So
I was going to ask you, did you get anything about that they designed their home, the La Pietra, from their Italian where they had their honeymoon? I just was curious to know if the building, the Dillingham building, had any kind of architectural feature type thing. You know, like Italy, the house was, their home was built, La Pietra, as a copy of that, where they were at honeymooning.
I have heard that, yes, that they wanted to recreate where they honeymooned. I don't know exactly where that was in Italy, but that's what I've heard about La Pietra.
Well, their house, the one around Dillingham where the school for girls is now, is the place that was designed, that La Pietra it's called. That was once Dillingham house. And that was the place that they had their honeymoon. So I can recreate it. That's the reason I asked about the other building.
Yeah, they're waiting for you. Chapman's about to sign on. I think the one in Italy is actually called La Pietra.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
They use the same name, but I'm not sure.
I think I've heard that.
Okay, looks like we're all back and continue on with our next nomination with the Naval Station Pearl Harbor Library Navy Relief and Chapel. And Angie, you're up again.
Okay. Okay. Aloha Chapel. Got quite a few names. The longer one's up there at the top of the screen. It's also referred to as Building 1514. But anyway, Aloha Chapel is the first synagogue and I told you I was twisted. Aloha Chapel is the first synagogue building built by the U.S. Navy on a military base specifically as a place of Jewish worship. The Navy had previously incorporated synagogues for Jewish worship only within existing facilities. Designed by Vladimir Osipov and his firm Osipov, Snyder, Rowland, and Goetz, it is an outstanding example of Hawaiian modern style. The building was designed late in Osipov's career, 1975, and is considered eligible despite being a religious property because its primary significance is derived from its historical importance and its architectural distinction. The Naval Station Pearl Harbor Library Naval Relief Chapel Facility 1514 is located at the junction of Kamehameha Highway and the Makalapa Gate Road, adjacent to Makalapa Gate at Pearl Harbor. The building is oriented with its long axis in the northeast-southwest direction. And you can see it right there. The building is situated in a swale that places much of the construction below the level of the adjacent highway. The striking arched barrel vaults of the roof project above the grade level of the highway, making them visible to passing motorists. The roof line forms a distinctive marker from outside the base. The single-story concrete building has an irregular footprint. It is a relatively low, sprawling building that is divided into three uses: the synagogue, medical clinic, originally a library, and the Navy Marine Corps Relief Society that has been in that location since it was built. Each portion is separated from the other by walls that do not allow interior passage from one use area to the other. And these are elevations of the 1970s drawing by Osipov, Snyder, Rowland, and Goetz. Each vault is 39 feet wide, long, excuse me, by 13 feet wide and extends 9 feet above the flat roof. Three of the four vaults cover a portion of the synagogue, while the adjacent three vaults cover an open courtyard next to the synagogue. The remaining six vaults cover a section of the medical clinic, which was, as I just noted, originally designed as a library. The Hawaiian modern style is characterized by designs that subscribe to the general modernity of the international style while attempting to integrate the cultural and topographical character of the Hawaiian region. For Osipov, this included integrating the interior of the buildings with the outdoors and minimizing the separation between the building and the site. Osipov is well known for his contributions to the development of the Hawaiian modern movement. From the end of World War II through the late 70s, Osipov produced many of the Hawaiian modern designs that he is best known for today, placing him as a leading figure in the Hawaiian modern movement. In the mid-1950s, Osipov had hired several younger architects, including Sid Snyder, Alan Rowland, and Gregory Goetz, and in 1973, Osipov's firm incorporated as Osipov, Snyder, Rowland, and Goetz. The Aloha Chapel is an important part of the portfolio of the later work that cemented Osipov's place as a catalyst of the Hawaiian modern style, but Facility 1514 is often overlooked in examinations of his work. This may be because the building is largely inaccessible to the public without access to the Joint Base military compound. The military, though, does appreciate the exceptional nature of its design, as evidenced in a Department of Defense publication noted the architect titled "The Architecture of the Defense." I'm going to start again. The Architecture of the Department of Defense, a Military Style Guide, published in 2011. This guide chronicles the evolution of architectural styles on military bases and features Facility 1514 as one of four religious facilities in the United States that illustrate mid-century modern excellence in design. Aloha Chapel is used to showcase some of the hallmarks of the style in this brochure. And that's it right there. A little bit about the history of Jews in Honolulu. The first Jews to arrive in the Hawaiian Islands is not specifically documented, but it's likely they arrived during the first half of the 1800s. They had been traders from Europe or sailors on American whaling vessels. In 1856, the first Jewish business opened in Honolulu called Grinbon and Company. It was a clothier. And by the late 1870s, other Jewish businesses had opened on Oahu as well as neighbor islands. In an interesting story was in 1886, an itinerant peddler named Elias Abraham Rosenberg arrived from San Francisco, with a Sefer Torah. I don't know how to pronounce that, so somebody can tell me. And embellished silver yad, which is a pointer. Which is what this is. This is the pointer. Rosenberg soon became a royal confidant and astrologer to King Kalakaua, teaching the monarch Hebrew and casting elaborate horoscopes. He was appointed appraiser of customs for the Kingdom of Hawaii, but after only about 6 months, he departed for San Francisco, where he died soon after, leaving the Torah and the Yad with Kalakaua. The first Jewish congregation in Honolulu was formed in 1901 by 30 members prominent in the Jewish community. And then the Jewish Welfare Board, which was an organization supporting Jewish military personnel, made its first presence in Hawaii in 1933. And by 1951 had reorganized as the Temple Emmanuel, the church, the synagogue that's on the Pali now. The congregation counted about 100 families as members, and by 1959, they were planning said temple building at 2550 Nu'uanu Avenue, and the architect was a congregation member and former Asipof employee, Edward Sullum. And on military installations, the first Jewish synagogue on a Navy base in the United States opened its doors in 1942, in Norfolk, Virginia. Protestant and Catholic chapels were opened in December the previous year, and the space for the Jewish synagogue was created in an area that connected the Protestant and Catholic church chapels. It is recognized as having the as being the oldest and most permanent Jewish synagogue. However, it was added as a later modification and not a purpose-built dedicated synagogue, as is Aloha Chapel. Facility 1514 is the first synagogue designed and built by the Navy solely for the Jewish faith. Before it was built, both in Hawaii and on the mainland, Jewish military personnel worshipped off-base or in Jewish synagogues incorporated into buildings that either served other faiths or had been built for other purposes. Prior to Facility 1514's construction, Jewish religious services at Pearl Harbor were held in a Quonset hut, also called Aloha Chapel, which served a number of other functions, including Christian services and associated activities. In 1971, Rabbi Lieutenant John J. Rosenblatt arrived at Pearl Harbor as the new Jewish Navy chaplain. Rosenblatt would become the Jewish activities coordinator for all military personnel in the Mid-Pacific region and a prominent proponent for the synagogue project. Upon his arrival, he estimated that the Jewish population in Hawaii's armed forces stood at roughly 1,000. In the interest of providing a place where all Jewish traditions, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, felt welcome, Rosenblatt created a new tradition at the synagogue that was still in effect years after his departure. He asked congregants to vote every Friday night on the choice of prayer book corresponding to the three respective traditions to be used in that night's service. Planning for the synagogue began in 1972 with strong support from Rabbi Rosenblatt. He assisted in the design of the new synagogue and obtained some of its religious items from Israel. Throughout his career, he helped build or renovate 18 military synagogues, but his wife later noted that of all of them, he had been particularly proud of the Aloha Jewish Chapel in Hawaii. The exterior surface is a split-face concrete masonry units and distinctive arch vault roofline, and the low massing of the building remain as constructed. The thin board frame concrete roof arches are the primary character defining feature. A small inset courtyard with planting is located at the entry to the synagogue, and another inset courtyard that is mostly paved is in, is located at the entries to the clinic and naval relief areas. The synagogue was dedicated on December 14th, 1975 by visiting Rear Admiral Bertram Wallace Korn, the highest ranking rabbi in the U.S. military. The building was recognized in local newspapers as the first building designed and built by the Navy solely for the Jewish faith. So it was a big deal. The library comprise the center and largest section of facility 1514 with the synagogue on the north side. And the Navy Marine Corps Relief Society portion occupying the section at the southwest end of the building that has a flat roof with no vaults. Sometimes circa 1999, the Pearl Harbor Base Library facility at 1514 closed and the space was adaptively reused to function as a medical clinic. Today, the clinic is referred to as the Makalapa Annex, an adjunct to the nearby Makalapa Clinic, and houses several programs, including Sports Medicine Rehabilitation Therapy, or SMART, Travel Medicine Clinic, and Preventative Medicine Clinic. The rear, east side of the building is set near the property boundary, along with a small paved parking area. A larger paved parking area is located at the front west facade. The Navy Marine Relief Society still has offices within Facility 14, as I mentioned, and this is the courtyard where those other two uses are entered. The interior of the chapel features acoustic plaster insets in the arch ceiling, exposed board form concrete, natural finished wood paneling, trim and balances, which the drawings indicate are made of Philippine mahogany. The building illustrates Osipov's use of natural light, moderating prevailing winds and weather, and creating a flowing indoor-outdoor relationship and adapting the building to the site. The SMART Clinic is the medical portion of the facility occupying the center of the building and is accessed through that courtyard we just saw. This is the original library, and the library reading room was located under the six vaults with the book stacks at the rear under the flat portion of the roof. Although the interior layout has changed, the arched roof form with glazing is retained. The Aloha Chapel is significant at the national level under National Register Criterion A as the first synagogue built. Do you guys know it's first synagogue built for the Navy? On a military base, specifically as a place for Jewish worship. The Navy has previously incorporated synagogues for Jewish worship only within existing facilities. It is also significant under Criterion A as the work of a master and an outstanding example of his interpretation of the Hawaiian modern style. It meets criteria, National Register criteria considerations A and G for its historical importance and its architectural distinction. It was designed late in Osipov's career, and the period of significance is the date of its construction, 1975. The Naval Station Pearl Harbor Navy Relief Chapel retains good integrity. There have been very few changes to the immediate surroundings since the building was constructed. Integrity of design materials and workmanship are retained, with the exterior of the building mostly free of any alterations. Changes to the exterior are very minor and consist of replacement doors at the clinic and at the rear of the building. The synagogue interior retains its original design and materials and finishes. The interior of the library and naval relief areas have been updated, but the general structure remains. And no permanent walls have been added inside. Those are all temporary partial height walls, as you saw. The property continues to express the historic character and aesthetic sense of time it was built, and is sufficiently intact to convey this association to an observer. Oops, I forgot to say thank you. There was a thank you slide.
Thank you, Angie.
Oh, well.
Okay, questions for Angie?
I have a short comment. While Angie, just as she was presenting the section of the synagogue, my phone pinged with the breaking news that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died.
That's horrible.
Thanks for sharing that, Pat.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop the meeting totally, no. But it was at such a time when you were showing this beautiful building and the aspect of it with the Navy.
Yeah.
No, thank you, Pat. Thank I think that was thank you for all to have a moment too, to think about that. Thanks. Okay, anybody with questions for Angie or comments?
Well, I got one comment, and just talk about having this be the nomination that we're considering in this moment, that it would be this chapel. But it's not 50 years old, and it has not reached the 50-year status. So I just wanted to throw that in case nobody had taken out their calculator. It's only 45 years old. So I want to just mention that. It might generate some conversation.
Right. So, Dr. Downer, can you confirm that that means we cannot consider this for the state register, but we can consider forwarding onto the national register or recommend it?
That is correct. It must be 50 years old to be eligible for the Hawaii register. However, places of exceptional importance can be listed on the national register that are less than 50 years old.
Okay, anybody have any questions or comments related to that, or are there questions about the building?
I just wanted to weigh in that I have no problem putting it on the national register. I mean, I think that we've had this conversation a couple of times about something to being of, you know, national significance when it's going to go on before it's 50 years old under the national. And, you know, the more I think about this and study it, and really, it just seems like it qualifies to go on the National Register, even though it's only 45 years old. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
Was it nominated just because it's on the heart line or near it, or is it totally independent of that?
No, this is a heart one also. The rail is going right practically over it.
Well, that's what stimulated the...
Yes. This is mitigation, just like all the other ones tonight have been.
As Nancy was saying, we, a property less than 50 years old that we reviewed was also an Ossipoff design. It was a beach house. And it seems that this building does have exceptional importance to considering all of its aspects and is worth approving given criterion G.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys heard about the Dilks beach house, the one you were just referring to, the one that did not go on the state register but was forwarded straight to the national register. It did get on the National Register. It came back with no comments, and it was featured on the NPS site as an example of, an interesting nomination. That was until the Dilks asked that it be removed because they felt like it was highlighting their precious artworks too much. So it's not up there now, but it was up there for quite a while as an example. So I just wanted to let you guys know that it was very well received by NPS.
Yeah, I was just gonna add, that's great, Angie, and I'm really pleased with that. This meets all the kind of, it's almost like a poster child for the kind of property that they say will be eligible prior to 50 years.
Yeah.
It's really designed for a piece of work by a major architect who's no longer alive, just like the other one, right?
One more thing, I think it's interesting having sort of put those Quonset huts on and sort of the similarity between the Quonset huts and also Chapman. I noticed that you weighed in on the
Kimball. Yeah,
the Kimball. Like the harmonic convergence of the Kimball.
I thought of the Quonset huts
and
too.
The Quonset huts, it's like very interesting. Yeah,
I thought it looked like the Quonset huts too, but it's uncanny how much it looks like the Kimball.
Yeah. It was not lost on me, the similarity between the mats and Quonset huts in this building. You know, there's what, 7 vaults in this one and 6 for the other one?
And it is. So ultimately, where did his inspiration come? Was it the Quonset huts or the Kimball? Quonset huts or the Kimball?
Exactly. There's actually, there's 12 barrel vaults.
Oh, sorry. No,
it's okay, but it's like two sections of 6.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough.
Yeah. Kimball has 15.
This was somewhere in between the Quonset huts.
For anybody that doesn't know the Kimball, and I'm sure everybody does know, it's an incredible art museum in Dallas-Fort Worth, designed by like one of the great architects of like ever. My hero, Louis Kahn.
There's a link in the chat if you don't know.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful building. I've been there. It's just amazing.
Okay, other questions or comments? All right, would anybody like to make a motion? Last one of the day.
Okay, I'll try. I move we recommend the Aloha Chapel. See, we can't recommend it to the state, but to the National Register of Historic Places under criteria A and C, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll second it. That. Oh, either one.
Go ahead.
You can have it, Bill.
That was a tie.
Seconding is the easiest thing to do.
Okay, we'll give that one to Bill.
Okay.
Seconded by Bill Chapman. Okay. Any other comments? Dr. Downer, was that the correct wording?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Then we'll take a vote, please, for Paul's motion to recommend this for the National Register. All in favor? Say aye. Raise your hand.
Nancy Peacock, yes. Aye.
Aye, Bill Souza.
Okay, 7 yeses and 0 noes. Great, thank you, Angie.
Thank you guys for putting up with me for all of these hours. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for putting up with us. Okay, thank you. I'm done with nominations. Looks like next on the agenda is the 2021 meeting dates. Chandra, you want to talk about that, or do you want me to just list out what you have stated here? Or I guess that was Tanya.
Hi, this is Tanya. Chandra's not here. Okay, you can take it away. Those are just the dates I know of.
Okay. We have March 5th, June 4th, August 6th, and November 19th. I think we sort of all weighed in earlier whether those were a problem. Those were right now the selected date, so I think that's what we'll be going forward with. Submitted nominations for March 5th. Can SHPD weigh in on that at all?
Yes, I did get 3 submitted so far. I believe the deadline to submit for the March 5th is still open, so we may or may not receive additional nominations, but so far we have 3.
Okay. Do you recall around when that deadline is?
Let me pull up the website real quick.
I don't know the exact date, but it will be the first week in January.
Okay.
And then you might see that some of the ones that were deferred might come around in that meeting.
Right. I think we had, looks like we had 2 that were deferred.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And did we successfully add in the limited meeting for the next time, or do we need to?
You need a motion on that.
Motion.
I know we had a motion to actually put it on the agenda, but now we have to make a motion to actually have the motion.
Okay. Somebody like to make it. No, thank you, Nancy. Would somebody like to make a motion related to the limited meeting?
I'd be happy to give it a try. I move that we conduct a limited meeting to visit the sites for the March 5th, 2021 meeting for reasons having to do with health, safety, the security, liability, et cetera.
Privacy.
Privacy. I thought I said that. Privacy, yes.
So this would be for March 4th.
This would be, I assuming that, I don't have my calendar in front of me, but if March 5th is a Friday, I would assume we're going to do it on March 4th. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Is there a second?
I second.
Pat seconds. Okay. Need to take a vote on approving that. All in favor of having a limited meeting on March 4th, please raise your hand. Yes.
Nancy, yes.
It looks like we have, who are we missing? Where's Bill Salza? Well, we have six yeses. I think we lost Bill.
Yeah.
Okay, six yeses and one missing. Okay, any other questions or comments? Dr. Downer, did you have anything else?
I do not.
Okay. Tanya, you have anything else?
No, I do not.
Okay. Anybody, anything else from the board?
I wonder if we'll be together really in March or whether we'll be Zooming.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I think it'll be Zooming. That's my prediction.
Oh. Bill, you'll have to come up with a new background for that meeting.
Come up with this. I did already. I've changed twice in the course of this meeting. This is my luxury apartment in Kakaako, where I live virtually.
Nice choice. Okay, that looks like it. Everybody then, thank you. Meeting adjourned. Everybody.
Motion, I think, do you have to take a motion for adjournment? Maybe not. I can't remember.
Alan?
No, you do not need a motion to adjourn.
Oh, okay, good.
Great. I'm just going to adjourn it then.
Thank you, Katie.
Yeah,
thank you, Katie. Well done. Good meeting. Thank you, everybody.
Bravo.
Nice to see
you
all.
Good weekend, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.